Well, tobacco growing in Gloucestershire and Worcestershire, 1625 to 1700. No wonder we got a good turnout with such a snappy little title. And I'd like to thank the Bristol Radical History Group for inviting me to give this talk this evening. Copies of the slides and the handout that's going around. I can email them to you if you just give me your email address. So if you pass this around, you're under no obligation to give me your email address, of course. Okay, three main strands. It's lightning talk, right? How poor smallholders in the 17th century Gloucestershire and Worcestershire resisted continued attempts by the state to prevent them from growing tobacco. And this is very much linked to the talk which has just gone on about traditions and customs and how things come against the law. It's been on for nearly 100 years in Gloucestershire and Worcestershire, in the Cotswolds. How their lives of these tobacco growers were linked to the lives and struggles of indentured labourers, slaves and native people in what is now called Virginia, USA. And also a look at and a quick discussion, if we've got time, of today's tobacco industry and the repression of subsistence farmers in Afghanistan. If you want. Okay, introduction of tobacco to Europe and England. Very, very, very condensed thing this. Okay, and the growth of the English colonial tobacco trade in the 17th century. Okay, prehistory, very little evidence really of use of tobacco in Africa or the Near East. But where it was a hugely cultural and significant importance was in what are now called the Americas. Yeah, it was very important to all those cultures of what is now South America, and then it moved up into North America and the Native Americans. Hugely important cultural icon. The first European to come across tobacco was a man called Mr. Columbus, Christopher Columbus, and is now abolished Columbus Day, which is run by Native Americans all across the USA. Are there any Americans in the audience, Nancy? Okay, so it was 1492. Columbus was actually given tobacco, and he threw it away. He thought it was just a worthless load of garbage that these Native Americans thought was really important. And the first people, there were two Spaniards on Cuba who first indulged in smoking tobacco. They were the first Europeans to do this. Okay? That's when it happened, 1492, significant year. And there's a little quote here from 1586, I think it is. Yeah, 1588. There is a herb called upuwok, but the Spaniards generally call it tobacco. Okay, and this is in the history of Virginia. So they're starting to discover the importance of tobacco that early. So Spain had the monopoly on the tobacco industry through their Southern American colonies. And it became a very, very popular drug in England in the 1500s, in the beginning of the 1600s. And continually, the English state tried to break the monopoly of Spanish tobacco imports into England. And they did this through various means of taxation and laws on import. But also, most importantly, they encouraged the production of tobacco as a cash crop in Virginia, United States, in Jamestown in particular. And they did this as part of a complex political strategy of in late Tudor, the Stuart times, and the Cromwellian Republican times as well. So the late 1500s, all the way through to the middle of the 1600s. Okay, and one of the ways to try to break the Spanish monopoly on tobacco was to encourage domestic production of tobacco. And that took place mainly just up the River Severn in the Cotswolds, in Worcestershire and Gloucestershire. It also happened in Ireland as well. Tobacco was growing in Ireland. And just when all this was taking off, when the local landlords, which about the previous speaker mentioned that the local lords in Gloucestershire and Worcestershire were the direct descendants of the Norman invaders of 1066, and they owned all the land, and anybody who grew tobacco on their land was actually a tenant of Monsieur Chandos, of Chandos Road, of White Ladies Road, Monsieur Chandos, Monsieur Berkeley, of Berkeley Castle, in Gloucestershire, Mr. Buffo, of the massive Buffo bloody hunts, all these French names, Monsieur Tracy, grand landlord, the area, and everybody had to work for them. They owned the land. They owned all those rights that had just been talked about, and they were starting to enclose land and also bargain with the king to invade the crown properties as well and overcome crown rights. Okay, so these barons, if you like, and these large landowners who still exist today, still own Berkeley Castle, etc., 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 were the big landowners who were planting this original tobacco. And they were also very involved in the Virginia Company that set up the tobacco industry in Virginia. Yeah. 1614 was the first export of tobacco from Virginia to England. Not the UK, to England. It wasn't the United Kingdom then. Before 1619, the price of tobacco was 1 and 6 or 2 shilling a pound, and imports to Bristol were £671 per annum in that year. Very small potatoes. While London imported £2,300 of English colonial tobacco, but the Spanish imports were £50,000. And it was superior tobacco as well. That also needs to be noted. But as Virginia tobacco started to take off and more imports came across, then more and more small farmers and yeomen, independent farmers, the local manor guy, they more and more of them were attracted to Virginia to grow tobacco because there was huge amounts of money in it already. Imagine the kind of, there were thousands of places in London where people just went and smoked tobacco. A bit like Amsterdam, going over there and having a reefer, Okay, but one of the consequences of this exploding Virginia tobacco industry was that it put more and more pressure on the relations with the native people of America, because partly after 3 years of growing tobacco you deplete the soil, and so they always had to keep on expanding the colony of Jamestown up the Chesapeake Bay and eventually create Maryland and all the rest of these colonies. And quite early on, in 1622, there was a major rebellion by the indigenous people against the colonists, and it was called the Indian Massacre, naturally. But even that didn't stop them coming. In 1624, the Stuart monarchy granted a monopoly to the English colonies for growing tobacco, and all tobacco had to be imported to London. Just like later on London got the monopoly on the slave trade, the African slave trade, London merchants were given the monopoly of handling all the tobacco that came from the new colonies in the Americas. And all tobacco came from what we call the Summer Islands, which is now known as Bermuda, and Virginia. And any tobacco landed in England and Wales had to be then taken directly to London. Couldn't be processed in the port of Bristol, for instance. And by 1630, the price, which was 1 and 6, 2 shilling a pound, had fallen to one pence a pound, 1 old pence. And even so, Spanish tobacco was incredibly popular. So this led to a huge crisis in Virginia. Bigger increases in production, lower in price, but still people preferring Spanish tobacco. So the state intervened. In 1624 proclamation, after London was given the monopoly of importing of English colonial tobacco, there was a huge growth in smuggling of tobacco by Bristol's merchant venturers. And I think that's really important to emphasise, is that the merchants we're talking about were the Bristol merchant venturers or the London merchant venturers, the same organisations that exist today. And I know we've got an ongoing debate with the merchant venturers about their history. And they were smuggling, right? Quite clear. Because all the ships had to go to London, ships decided, oh, we've got a bit of a leak, or we've hit bad weather, you know, we've got to pull into Bristol and unload there. But they didn't have a leak and there wasn't any bad weather, they just pulled into Bristol, right? So they were in, it was already preordained before the ships went out that they were going to come back to Bristol. And you must remember that a lot of the planters in Virginia were also the same merchants who were importing the tobacco and on the ships as well. They had a monopoly. So they were just doing it amongst themselves and their cousins. Quite often, if tobacco was landed, then they would bribe the customs officers and or local people on the dockside. Used to, you know, when the customs officer wasn't around, they'd get the tobacco off and ship it who knows where. Who knows where it went. And it's interesting also that those local people knew it was the merchant venturer's ships, knew it was the merchant venturers who were organising this. So the relationships between the common people, if you like, of Bristol and the rich merchants of what was to become Clifton was visible to all. It wasn't hidden then. The link's been broken, this kind of, you know, understanding the relationship between theft and what is not theft. Really interesting what you were saying earlier. It was so widespread that in 1639 the Privy Council received a long complaint from the farmers of customs, which is a nice way of describing a customs officer, isn't it? A farmer of customs, that Dartmouth, Bristol and Southampton are inclined to take hold of anything to deceive His Majesty. Get it. 1626, Charles I restricted the Spanish imports to Britain in favour of imports from Virginia and Bermuda. And then, to stamp out the domestic growth of tobacco as well, there were prohibitions in 1619, 1620, 1627, 1630 and 1634. Warrants were issued, you can read it yourself, to root out the crops, burn the crops, destroy the crops in Worcestershire and Gloucestershire, to protect the merchant interests and to protect the colonies of Virginia, etc. And also to set up a counteraction against the Spanish. So small wonder then that in Worcestershire and Gloucestershire the local farmers were in favour of the English Revolution led by Cromwell, etc. in 1640-1648, yeah? Because they were under attack by the monarchy. And if anybody's got the handout, you'll see that that attack was ferocious. 1641, local Bristol merchants, including Thomas Colston. Now I haven't found out if this is related to, you know, Mr. Colston of the statue in Bristol, but I imagine he is, or I haven't had time to delve into there. Okay, he was a fellow monarchist of Humphrey Hook and a member of the Virgin Venturers, and they tried cases of illegal tobacco smuggling which had occurred since 1639. when certain Brian Rogers took bribes for turning a blind eye to unloading of colonial tobacco in Bristol. In 1651, during the time of the Republic, Cromwell passed the Navigation Act, okay? The first Navigation Act. And this completed the monopoly system for English merchants, where they owned the plantations, owned the ships that brought the tobacco over to England, owned the docks in Bristol. The merchant venturers owned the Bristol docks. Owned the ships which then went to Africa, sold tobacco and exchanged tobacco for slaves in Africa. Then those slaves went over to the colonies and grew the tobacco which had actually enslaved them in the first place. A total global monopoly of production and distribution and processing. As economic dependencies of England, the Chesapeake colonies, that's Virginia, Maryland, etc., were bound into this system. Okay, and this system enabled England to receive all those raw goods, etc., etc., etc. Okay, it was 1650 also that England entered the slave trade in a legal way. This is under Cromwell. 1650, same time as the Navigation Act. This is a world vision that these guys had. A world vision. Wasn't parochial, wasn't London-based. They looked at the world to exploit the world and the labour of the world. And it was all part of Cromwell's Western design, which I've spoken to some people about before, and about when William Penn Sr., who's buried down at Redcliffe Church, went and took Jamaica eventually for Cromwell and started that base for the slavery circle. Then there was a following Navigation Act, which strengthened the first Navigation Act to make sure only British ships could take British products from British colonies. And I'm sure you all know the triangular trade, what's called the triangular trade, which is a big shorthand of manufactured goods going to Africa, being traded for Africans, those Africans being taken over to the Americas and then being paid for in goods, in raw materials, which are then brought back to UK and Europe, processed, and then those processed goods going to Africa, etc., etc., etc. But it was a lot more complicated than the triangular thing. I have a bit of an issue about that shorthand phrase. After the Navigation Acts, I've got to talk a bit about piracy. After the Navigation Acts, of course, got all these colonies, Virginia, these Yanks over here, that Yank there in particular, yeah, used to deal with all kinds of ships, yeah? But once the Navigation Act, 1651, came in, they could only deal with British ships, or they were breaking the law. But of course they broke the law. And they dealt a lot with Dutch ships, because the Dutch were a big colonial power in those days. So they would still load onto Dutch ships. And when Dutch ships were then denied access to the tobacco, they waited outside the Chesapeake Bay, or in the English Channel, or the Irish Channel, or in the Bristol Channel, and waited for the English ships to bring the tobacco. Then they'd just take the tobacco off them. Yeah? Quite handy. But they were called privateers. This is like a posh pirate. All right. Yeah. Hover offshore. Yeah. There's an example there of 8 ships with 6 more in reserve, waiting for the Alexandra of Bristol, about 60 leagues westward of Ireland. I lost the date, I didn't put the date, but it was between those years, about 1672, I think it was. So it actually promoted piracy.
Every time you bring a law in, someone's going to break it.
Okay, during the interregnum, during the Republic, Bristol Corporation, a.k.a. the Merchant Venturers, expressed a desire in its instructions for MPs to prevent the growth of English tobacco in Worcestershire and Gloucestershire because it was impeding their mercantile international trade. Yeah? They actually fought against domestic growth of tobacco, which is a really important point to come to later. And in 1692-93, Giles Merrick, a Bristol merchant and ex-mayor of Bristol, was prosecuted for importing tobacco on board a Dutch vessel. Major crime. But he didn't get hung or killed or anything for that. He just got a slap on the wrist. So, Virginia, early colonization, tobacco, monoculture, indentured servants, use of slaves, impact on indigenous peoples. Quick whiz through. Okay, yeah, it was also grown in Bermuda. A lot of talk, you know, everybody knows about Virginia tobacco and, you know, Golden Virginia and things like that. But it was also grown on Bermuda, and I just wanted to point that out as well. That was equally important at the time. Yeah, you know, Bermuda comes from Bermudez, Señor Bermudez, who first Europeans to land there. And then later on, it became an outpost of the Virginia Company. Yeah, they actually sent the guy who's mentioned on there, Richard Moore. He was actually a ship's carpenter, and he was made the governor because they needed to claim the land and get somebody in there. Yeah, pretty sharpish. And it was the staple of Chesapeake colonies in a broader sense than any other staple good or product the world has ever known. For all the processes of government, society, and domestic life began and ended with tobacco. That's all they did in Virginia, was tobacco. A little bit of corn, a few animals to grow on. But what they did was just grow tobacco, which depleted the soil, I say, within 3 years. And it became known as green gold tobacco. In 1701, the American colonies were England's most important trade partner after Holland. £205,000 worth of exports to Virginia, and Virginia imported £200,000 worth of British products, which is considerable in those days. But by 1760, the trade with the colonies was over £1 million, and the Tobacco Coast, which is the Chesapeake, provided Britain with 54% of all its imports and consumed 30% of its exports. That's how big the trade was and how important it was for the economy of England. And of the exports from North American colonies, tobacco accounted for over half of those exports in value, £900,000. So it was huge importance to the merchants of Bristol, for instance, this trade. Massive, massive amounts of money. But why was it no longer a scarce commodity by 1660? Because of the introduction of the slave trade. As the production of tobacco and demand for tobacco increased, and as Spanish tobacco was no longer allowed in the country, they needed slaves to grow the tobacco in the colonies. And without them, there'd be nobody to till the land, plant the seeds, raise the plants, harvest and cure the tobacco. And just to cover all eventualities, the government of Virginia passed an act in 1682 decreeing all blacks who aren't Christian, when purchased, will be slaves. So just to make sure, you know, to cut out any doubt at all that any African coming in was going to be enslaved. Between 1650 and 75, the Virginia slave population grew from 2% to 42% of the population. And so I've got to remember that in the latter half of the 1700s, half the slaves supplied to Virginia, sorry, in the first half of the 1700s, came on Bristol ships. There's a quick table of where you can see the correlation between the output of tobacco and the use of slaves. And it's quite clear on that table, really. And you can see by 1790, 42% of the population of Virginia were slaves. 1633, when they got up to 1.5 million pounds of tobacco exported per year, the demand for labour exceeded the supply of indentured servants, or indentured labour, which the previous speaker had talked about, hence the drive for slavery. Hence, in 1650, the legality of the slave industry by Britain, or by England. Tobacco was a currency. Any persons encouraged, which was mentioned by the previous speaker again, about goods being a currency, persons encouraging Negro meetings were to be fined £1,000 worth of tobacco, anyone letting Negroes keep horses were fined £500 of tobacco, and of course the old church was in there, the old Church of England was well in. Yeah. In 1639, clergy were paid for their tithes. That's 1/10 of what you produce goes to the church to keep the priest, keep the vicar and the sexton and the other functionaries. They had to pay £10 of tobacco for every pole. And a pole, I think there's, I can't remember, 80 poles to an acre. So a considerable amount of tobacco went to the church. And even by 1758, when slavery is huge proportions, the authorities in Virginia tried to get them to accept money instead. No, they still wanted tobacco grown by slaves. They had the choice. A couple of images of slaves working in Virginia. I think it's quite interesting. You see that in both those images, the older one down bottom left and the one above, the more modern representation of slavery in tobacco fields, is the stumps of felled trees, because they always had to expand and develop and develop and develop, because it kept on depleting the soil of Virginia. I just thought it was also important, I think, to show that the skills weren't only field skills but also craft skills as well, of coopers and hoopers and all the rest of it. People became doctors and all kinds of things. That wasn't just field work. And women became worked in the fields as well, and they actually displaced European white women from the fields. It allowed women, white women, to leave working in tobacco fields and employ a slave instead, who could be a black woman. So they had this hierarchy of labour as well. It's quite interesting. Some typical depictions of slaves. Most images you see in this 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, are European origin, being painted by white people or drawn by white people, white Europeans. And the one at the bottom in particular, it's quite interesting. There's a little dragon in the back. I'm not quite sure what that's about, really. A little dragon there. Sort of breathing fire, I suppose it's smoking, I don't know. Common preconception, everybody working in the fields all day. But just like the Cheltenham and Worcestershire, Gloucestershire smallholders who fought against the state, so did the slaves, of course. In 1663 was the first major slave uprising in the Americas, and it happened in Virginia. And I'll just let you read through the ones on the screen. Can you all see it? Yeah, no. 1663, Virginia, first serious slave conspiracy involving both white servants, the indentured laborers, and black slaves in Gloucester County in Virginia. Yeah. Gloucester, you know, all those Norman families, yeah. 1730, Virginia, there were slave conspiracies. 1800, Gabriel Prosser wanted to establish a black state in Virginia and had rounded up 1,000 slaves who were going to fight against the authorities in Virginia to establish that state. No small potatoes. Goes on, 1631, Virginia, Nat Turner's revolt. 57 white colonists were killed by Nat Turner's men, and women probably. and to help to start changing the perception of the way people were viewed by the state in Virginia. In 1834, in St. Kitts, I popped this one in just to show that some of the people from St. Kitts were actually sent to Bermuda, which is, of course, one of the original tobacco places along with Virginia. And they were striking and then revolted against the apprenticeship system, which we talked about, those who were at the previous radical history events will know about. But it was their revolts in particular which pushed for the end of the institution of slavery in the colonies itself. 1841, slave revolt on a slave ship, the Creole. The slaves overpowered the crew and sailed the vessel and gained their freedom on the Bahamas. And of course, then you got John Brown in 1856, who's commemorated in song. Yeah. And the famous Harper's Ferry. A very small group of frustrated and desperate men who led a small revolt at Harper's Ferry. They were actually at Harper's Ferry there was an armory, and they were trying to get all the arms out to then go and arm other people. But of course, became very, very famous and a standard and an image for the American Civil War and the end of slavery itself. So between 1830 and 1860, from Virginia, 300,000 slaves were taken to Arkansas and then to the Mississippi and the Delta for the new product, which superseded tobacco in lots of ways, which was cotton. So all those struggles were going on, bear them in mind, in Virginia. Not all white people were bastards, of course. A considerable number of white people opposed slavery, and that was from the anti-slavery alphabet of the anti-slavery movement in America. Tea is a rank tobacco plant raised by slave labor to a poisonous and nasty thing for gentlemen to chew. So we're coming to Gloucestershire and Worcestershire, as quick as I can. You get 150 million tobacco seeds for 1 ounce. So it's dead easy to smuggle, right? It's in your pocket, you can have millions of tobacco seed. Have that wallet, you've got millions of tobacco seed. And that's how it came into Worcestershire and Gloucestershire. You just smuggled aboard in somebody's pocket and then planted. And that's the area. Those who've got handouts have got this little map on the back as well. It's a huge area of tobacco planting. And after 1619, it was totally illegal. So the Cotswolds and the Evesham, the Vale of Evesham, were the areas. I also came across a reference just outside of Bristol, just north of Bristol, so the kind of Kingswood area, but I haven't included this today. And they took on three different states and won. They were totally undefeated, these guys and women. Right from, as I said, right from the beginning, they wanted to break the Spanish stranglehold and monopoly on tobacco. And right back in 1598, the House of Lords were talking about domestic growth and growth in Ireland, because England owned Ireland. In 1619, the London merchant John Strafford purchased spare land in and around Winchcombe, which is right near Cheltenham. And that was the focus of the tobacco industry, was Winchcombe. And he's a strange guy, and he tied in with the local Norman landowners, right, with the Tracys of the area around Cheltenham. They had the land, he had the money. He was a salt merchant, and Winchcombe was the centre of the salt trail, the old salt trail, right from Saxon times all the way through. It crisscrossed, and salt was a very important commodity, and Winchcombe was a salt town. But the money from salt had declined. It was also a big pilgrimage area, but with the eradication of Catholicism, there weren't any pilgrims, and the whole town, the village, was in decline. And they saw this as an opportunity to actually invigorate the area and get some money and prosperity. But in 1619, just after they planted the tobacco, in came this law by Act of Parliament to say that, no, you can't do it. Coincidence? I don't think so. We're talking about, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of acres being laid out for tobacco. 1631, still taking on the Stuart state. Charles I's proclamations were read out in Gloucestershire forbidding the growth of tobacco. JPs in Gloucestershire and Worcestershire were urged to take immediate action, but because they were also the local landowners, it didn't happen. And because they were getting rent from their tenant farmers, either in tobacco or in cash, then they had no interest in destroying their own lucrative business. In 1635, officers trying to interfere with tobacco growth met with resistance. In 1640-48, Gloucestershire became and Gloucester itself became a bastion of republicanism against the monarchy. And this was one of the reasons why. It's because the monarchy was trying to stop tobacco growth. In 52, now we've got the Commonwealth state, the scene off. Physically chopped off the head of Stuart, right? Yeah, then you had another state, the Commonwealth state, run by Cromwell. In 52, there was a fresh act prohibiting, because of his design and the Navigation Act and all the rest of it, yeah, and he wanted to encourage this world vision. Cromwell actually imposed an act against the growth of tobacco in England. But the growers got a year's reprieve. They said, oh no, we're really hard up, you know, we are Republicans, just like you, you know, we are hard up. Give us another year. So he gave them another year, and then 2 years later, after they'd been totally forbidden and done this deal, the crop was even bigger. You know, more and more people are growing tobacco because there was so much money in it. So much money. You could just grow it in your backyard, or your field this big, and you could have a big cash crop. Very easy. It's unskilled labour to grow it as well. It's just a weed. But the Bristol merchants for the second time protested and instructed their MPs to prevent the growth of English tobacco just up the road. Special commissioners came along to enforce the law, but locals raised a force of some 300 horse and foot to resist government troops. To resist the troops that had won the English Revolution. And in 1655, it was so popular that the local hangman of Gloucestershire said, "The very planting of tobacco has proved the decay of my trade. For since it has been planted in Gloucestershire, especially at Winchcombe, my trade has proved worth nothing." And then he went on to say, "Then 'twas a merry world for me, for indeed before tobacco was there planted, there being no kind of trade to employ men and very small tillage, necessity compelled poor men to stand by my friends by stealing of sheep and other cattle, breaking of hedges, robbing orchards and what not." All the things the previous speaker talked about. So people actually stopped committing the common crimes and committed this big mass crime of growing tobacco. Now it gets a little interesting. 1658, Thomas Colloch, who was one of these monopoly merchants, owned plantations, owned the ships, owned the processing in London. He was one of the 8 signatories of a petition to stop tobacco growth in England. But then he got a letter from his mate Joe. "I got together," says Joe, 36 horses and went to Cheltenham early and found an armed multitude guarding a tobacco field. We broke through them and went to the town of Cheltenham, but found no peace officer, but a rabble of men and women calling for the blood for their tobacco. So, had there been any action, if the troops had attacked the local people, blood would have been spilt. The soldiers stood firm, the government soldiers, and with cocked pistols bade the multitude to disperse, but they would not. And then, 200 more of them came from Winchcombe to join him in Cheltenham. And they backed off, the government backed off, because they were, once they shot their pistols, the crowd would have just swamped them. They'd have just taken them, wouldn't they? Taken their pistols, taken their armour, taken their sidearms and everything. And most importantly, the local constabulary, the local JPs, the local authorities just stood by and did nothing, because it was a common right to grow tobacco by that time. It had been growing for over 30 years on 1619. So 38, 39 years have been growing tobacco. And this is probably a description of the same event. It's Colonel Wakefield, who was governor of Gloucestershire, and he had a troop of horse to uproot the crops. And it was described, the country did rise against the great body to the number of 500 or 600 people, giving speeches that if Wakefield and his soldiers did come on, the tumult would have been so great he was constrained to draw and do nothing. The state had to withdraw in the face of 500 or 600 local people in Worcestershire and Gloucestershire. And so it goes on. In 1659, as force was not effective, they resorted to fines, and they started fining people so much tobacco per poll. Not forbidding the growth of tobacco now, but using it as a source of revenue in tobacco. And then came the restoration of the crown, the Orange Order took over. And these were years of fierce counter-revolution in England. So anybody who supported the revolution and supported Parliament and Cromwell was very, very nervous, to say the least. In 1662, there was direction again that all crops should be banned. And the long-term monarchist Sir Humphrey Hook, who was an associate of Thomas Colston at those trials earlier on, yeah, you remember that? Yeah. Now Hook was Bristol-based, all Ashley and Ashley Down was his manor. And he was the local lord there, Hook. He was an ex-mayor of Bristol and the sheriff of Gloucestershire, and was ordered in the May of that year to resist anybody who tried to stop him from destroying the crops. And the growing of tobacco actually spread, and it spread again to Ireland. Nothing they could do to stop it. The Diary of Samuel Pepys, 1667. So this is 48 years on from the first prohibition of growing tobacco. He said, the lifeguard are the troops that guard the king or the queen. Yeah, they are the lifeguards of the monarch. They are the top soldiers in the land. They are the most loyal, philosophically sound troops in the army in England at the time. They were sent down to the country about some insurrection. They were sent to Winchcombe to spoil the tobacco there, which it seems the people there do plant contrary to law, and have always done so, and have been under force and danger of having it spoiled, as it has been oft times, and yet they will continue to plant. And even the crack troops of the Prince of Orange, you know, the King, King William III or King William II, depending on which country you're in, they couldn't defeat the local people. There were a couple more of those big clashes. So when did it end? Nobody actually knows. Definitely they were still growing tobacco up to 1700. Definitely they were never stopped. They were never defeated. Ever. Ever, ever. The three states had had a go at them. And in 1900, there were still the remains of tobacco curing sheds around Winchcombe. So local people were still growing tobacco in the 1800s around Winchcombe. And plants can still be found growing wild. not the nicotina flower plants that you have in your garden, but actual, 6 foot high tobacco plants can still be growing around there. Importantly, it wasn't like a digger thing, you know, the diggers taking over common land. I don't think it was that kind of thing. It was more an autonomous state around Worcestershire and Gloucestershire. And in fact, those Norman families were called the Kings of the Cotswolds. Right? The Kings of the Cotswolds. And they had that protection. Those local people had the protection. But there must have also been a mutuosity. What's that word? Mutuality. Yeah, another word as well from that film. Yeah, so they had a mutual interest in seeing off the state. Very interesting. Today's tobacco industry, tax people in the UK spend, £12 billion a year on tobacco products. £10 million of that is tax. European tobacco in 1997. The EU spent £735 million on subsidies for the European tobacco industry. That's £5,370 per tobacco grower in France and Greece and Germany and Italy, etc., etc., and Belgium. But the vast majority of tobacco grown in Europe goes to Eastern Europe or is dumped in Africa because it's not good enough. So we're paying for something. So talk about, you know, legally illegality. It's just ridiculous, isn't it, really? We're actually paying, you and I, for something that isn't even used. Are there any similarities between what's happening in Afghanistan today? I think there might be. Some poppy farms in Afghanistan say the government's poppy eradication campaign will leave them jobless and penniless, just the same as the Gloucestershire and Worcestershire people who were starving before the advent of tobacco. And the Daily Telegraph says, corruption in the Western-backed government is undermining the poppy eradication campaign in Helmand, that's a southern province that the British are policing. The original intention was to take over 22,000 hectares in the province, which accounts for 40% of the poppy production. But in actual fact, the British and the local authorities can only control 7,000 hectares of that area. Just this way the state couldn't control people in Worcestershire and Gloucestershire. Similar kind of thing happening out there in Afghanistan. The cost of the war in Afghanistan, this is USA only, from 2002 to 2007, was £126 billion, that's £25 billion a year. If they spent £24 billion a year, then hunger on a world scale would be reduced by half by 2015. So state authorities have a choice, just like they had a choice in England in the 1600s and 1700s. They could either say, we'll grow tobacco in England. Great, everybody likes it. Great demand for it. No, we prefer to grow it using slave labour in the Americas. They had a choice. And quite often you hear apologists say, there's always been slavery, you know, it's old as the hills, there's always been slavery. No, they had a choice. They could have actually grown this bloody crop in England. It was being grown in England. But it could have grown it in Ireland. It could have grown it in Scotland. It could have grown it anywhere. It's a very hardy plant. But no, they chose a system which depended on slave labour. And just as today, they got a choice of war and oil or the elimination of world hunger in a matter of half a lifetime. Thank you for listening so patiently.
I actually want to have a cigarette. I'll be talking about brands goodbye in a minute, but if people want to come to you in a minute.